Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs, right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Emma Watsky, coming to you from Radio Adelaide, here in Tandunya, on the lands of Gunamina. Our team pays our deepest respect to Elders past, present and emerging. We extend this respect to all First Nations listeners and to the rightful custodians of the lands you're listening in from. And today on the show,
what we've seen is a great sense of community energy. We discovered that there are a number of people in the community that are willing to create and innovate solutions to address loneliness.
How is a pilot project overcoming one of the most challenging public health issues of our time? It's been 1 year since Spark, a community-led project, was launched to foster connection and tackle loneliness. Also, rigid ideas of masculinity are linked to violence, risky behaviour, and to poor mental health. That's the latest from a new report. So how can things change? And later.
So I think the agreement is a landmark in recognising that we're not on track and that more really needs to be done to keep that warming to 1.5 degrees and to limit that overshoot to as much as possible.
The COP30 climate conference held in Brazil has ended, but it's prompted many questions around future climate action and Australia's role in the next COP summit. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. We're on air across Australia, thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up, former Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce has announced his resignation from the National Party after 20 years representing the electorate of New England, a move coming in the final sitting day and week of Parliament. Amid a number of questions, Joyce has cited the changing political landscape across the world and his uncertainty around the coalition's success next election. So, what next? I spoke with Community Radio Network's political reporter, Noah Seckham. Barnaby Joyce has resigned from the Nationals. What's the reaction from Parliament House there?
Well, it's certainly been a bit of a divided approach, unsurprisingly, to that news. We've heard from the Nationals in the week leading up to this that they were talking to Barnaby Joyce, particularly his allies and friends within the party, so the likes of Matt Canavan and former leader Michael McCormack, urging him to stay in the party, saying that there was a lot more value to him being a part of something like the Nationals that he's been a part of for so long, broadly pointing to perhaps joining One Nation. So within the coalition, there's that sort of feeling. At the same time, Labour, of course, is jumping on this because for them it's really just another opportunity to shift focus onto the internal fighting of the coalition. We've had so much time spent on the net zero debate until that announcement was made, and even after the announcement was made, pointing out how business groups and environmental groups aren't happy with the coalition's stance. So Labour has actually had a pretty easy run since the election. And so this kind of adds to that pile of distractions from the government.
You did mention about a little bit regarding Pauline Hanson. There's a lot circulating on social media, videos of him eating an Australian-shaped steak with her. Is there any more that you can offer on this at all?
Well, it certainly sounds like something that Barnaby Joyce is heavily considering. As soon as he announced that he was stepping back from the Nationals party room at the start of October, more than just removing himself from leadership and policy positions. And at the time, there were rumours that he had called Pauline Hanson straight after a fundraising event over that weekend that the news was breaking. And then he kind of brushed those aside. But having seen this week on Monday night, that shared meal in Pauline Hanson's parliamentary office, and how well photographed and videoed and circulated that has been, it's hard to say that that was nothing, because no one sits down for dinner and takes a photo as two politicians if it doesn't mean anything. It probably actually goes down to political strategy, whether or not it looks better to be with Pauline Hanson for the next 2 years, or if it's better to do it as a 6 months leading up to the next election to be an independent free agent while he can. So we're still yet to see what he's actually going to decide on that front.
And what impact do you think his resignation will have on the dynamics of the Nationals caucus?
Well, it's certainly going to be an interesting one, considering that Barnaby Joyce was one of the most vocal opponents to net zero. And he said, I can't be a part of a coalition or a party that thinks that net zero should go ahead. So the fact that that did play a part in the net zero debate. We don't know to what extent, but it certainly did. And to see that he's still leaving the party after that happened, and a lot of criticism being levelled at Susan Lee is for bowing to the Nationals. So whether or not that shakes up any of the policy decisions in the coalition for the future, we're not sure. But also it throws questions up about David Littleproud's leadership of the Nationals. Mm-hmm. Barnaby Joyce is the third representative of the Nationals to resign from the party in some form or another. So to see this happening, although the Nationals aren't losing seats at elections, they're losing seats between elections, which whether or not that's entirely David Littleproud's fault is up for debate, but Barnaby Joyce certainly says that the leadership relationship hasn't been successful for a long time.
Barnaby Joyce was representative for 20 years in the Nationals. Do you think the impact of his departure will flow outwards at all regarding the dynamics of other parties or play into the minds of, you know, his voter base in regions and the like?
I think it's hard to say how much influence Barnaby Joyce's political manoeuvring actually has within Parliament itself. We've seen a lot of resignations crossing the floor and shuffling among parties, especially in the Senate in just the last few years. You know, Labor's Senator Fatima Payman moving to the crossbench over the handling of the Gaza war in July last year, and the Greens' Dorinda Cox moving to Labor in the Senate at the start of this year was also quite a spanner in the works and quite a surprise and not typically what you see. So I think this attitude of party loyalty is certainly not quite as strong as it used to be. And it's certainly the prospect of the crossbench, the independents, being able to do a lot more, I think is making the crossbench appear a lot more appealing for a lot more party politicians. And even these politicians like Barnaby Joyce, who have been in the party structure for decades.
Community Radio Network's political reporter, Noah Seckham, speaking with me.
Have you checked out The Wire? It's your national current affairs program. The Wire, taking an independent look at what's happening in Australia and around the world. Fresh voices, new points of view, current affairs with a difference. Don't miss The Wire, daily on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
According to a new report on youth mental health, too many young men in Australia are struggling in silence, pressured to appear tough, confident, and unemotional. New research, the Adolescent Man Box study, surveyed 1,400 young people and found rigid ideas of masculinity are linked to violence, risky behaviour, and also to loneliness and poor mental health. The Wire's Azuzana Carrasco spoke with Jennifer Park, CEO of Human Nature, about what these pressures look like in real life and why so many boys are turning away from traditional support services.
It's a very interesting study that's been released. When they talk about the man box, they're referring to a set of social, and I put rules in inverted commas, but they're social rules that pressure men and young men to behave according to really rigid masculine norms, such mm-hmm. as being dominant or emotionally closed off. And so what we see as a youth mental health service, the practical consequences for that is so many young men are then engaging in risky behaviours, bullying and violence. Often these are boys who have grown up with domestic violence themselves. Some of those young men are now using violence in their personal relationships, and that can be against their mother, their siblings, and also in new relationships, personal relationships that they're forming. What we also see is there's a real inability then for those young people to find invitational spaces where they can be honest about these challenges and have conversations that don't label them as toxic masculinity, but actually a non-judgmental spaces where young people can talk through these really complex issues.
In those invitational places that you were talking about, it's because the model takes therapy outside of clinical walls, let's say, like, for example, beaches, parks, community spaces. And can you explain why these environments are more effective, and particularly for boys who fall into what you call the missing middle?
Look, everything we do at Human Nature has been co-developed with the young people themselves. And so it was young people who told us for them to be able to access mental health support, they needed to have a sense of actually getting to know a practitioner and feeling cared about, that they wanted to feel like the practitioner got to know something about them other than just problem they were presenting with. And they talked about wanting it to be long-term support so that they could build up some trust and some safety. Mm-hmm. They also talked about the importance of having bodies moving and being side by side. So if you can imagine a therapist, mental health, qualified mental health professional sitting next to a young man by a river with fishing rods in their hands, how much more easily the conversation can flow compared to sitting in a room opposite each other, regardless of the skills of the practitioner, I have to say. And what we know, and there's a really strong growing body of evidence that even though there are youth mental health services funded by the government, young men in particular and Aboriginal young people and young people with childhood trauma mm-hmm. are not able to access those clinic-based settings. They just don't feel safe and meaningful for them.
Mm-hmm. That building of their relationship with their practitioner, it's probably one of the important points. In the evaluation of the university, Charles Sturt, it says that the approach is one of the most promising answers to the challenges raised in this Men Box report. I wanted to ask you about the evaluation. In this evaluation, what were the elements that were most impactful? Is it building the relationship with the practitioner one of them?
That's one of them, that's right. And I think it's an important point you raise, because what we found is that it's actually a whole suite of design elements that make this model so accessible for the young people most in need of mental health support and least able to tolerate clinical settings. And so it's not just one thread of that. It's having practitioners who travel to them. Sometimes we're meeting young person sitting, the practitioner will be sitting on the other side of a bedroom door because this young person hasn't left their bedroom to go other than to go to the toilet for 2 years.
Yeah.
And so we talk about working at the pace of trust.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is that on average, we support young people for 12 months
mm-hmm.
Because that's actually what's required for these young people to build that trust and that emotional safety with a mental health practitioner.
So given youth suicide remains the leading cause of death among young men between 15 and 24-year-olds, if state and federal governments invested in your model tomorrow, what do you think that it is immediate expansion or impact that you would be able to deliver to these young men?
Well, at the moment, we are entirely philanthropically funded. If we were offered funding by either federal or state government, we've built this model in a way that we're ready to replicate to other regional communities. But everything we've been doing has been thinking, what if we were 2 or 3 or 5 times our size? I really believe every regional community in Australia needs a human nature in their community. Step up, step down model, a really key missing piece of the mental health service system.
Mm-hmm.
And we're ready to go.
Jennifer Park, CEO of Human Nature, speaking with The Wire's Azuzana Carrasco. I'm Emma Watsky and you're listening to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs, right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. A huge hello to Three-Way Radio in Warrnambool and to our friends at ACCC in Alice Springs and, of course, to Tune FM in Armidale. The COP30 climate conference held in Brazil has come to an end, prompting many questions around future climate action and Australia's role in the next COP summit, with Adelaide's hosting opportunity now off the table. Professor Matthew Harrison, climate resilience leader at the University of Tasmania, has also pointed to the summit's focus on funding adaptability rather than targeting mitigation efforts around fossil fuels. The Wire's Sam Giorgio spoke with Professor Harrison to hear more.
Probably one of the big pluses was the just transition mechanism, which is basically anchoring labour rights and human rights and the inclusion of marginalised groups to a low carbon economy. And this didn't really come about by chance. People have been pushing for this for a long time. So effectively what that does is it gets rich or developed countries to pay developing countries to adapt to the climate crisis. Things like rising sea levels and floods and adapting to areas with extreme heat and fire risk and that sort of thing. So that's a really good thing. And Brazil As a sort of a sideline to COP30, Brazil launched what they call the Tropical Forests Forever Facility, which is basically a global investment fund for conservation and to prevent deforestation, which is also a good thing. The big negative is that the majority of the funding is towards adaptation. What that means is preventing sea level rise, preventing deforestation, adapting to heat waves, preventing extreme fires that you get with global warming. There's very little about mitigation. Mitigation means reducing CO2 emissions, reducing methane, reducing nitrous oxide. It's CO2 emissions that have contributed to the climate crisis in the first place. So effectively what they're doing is they're putting an ambulance at the bottom of the cliff rather than putting a fence at the top.
As you mentioned, the overall mitigation ambition was pretty weak, and some groups within the summit worked to prevent any reference to a transition from fossil fuels and inefficient fossil fuel subsidies. What's the significance of this?
If you boil it down, at its heart, you have this tension between economic growth and income and climate change mitigation. And that's because there's a strong coupling between productivity and greenhouse gas emissions. And it's difficult to decouple. You can, but it's difficult to do. All of this climate finance is really aspirational rhetoric. It's not a pledge. It's not an obligation. The big issue is that the operational detail is very limited. So you have this plan, which is all very well, like we're going to reduce global warming to 1.5 degrees, we're going to triple climate finance, which is good, but then you need to go back to your national government, to your state government, to your local councils to operationalise that detail. The big failing of these COP sessions is that they fail to reflect. They do it in a little way, but they fail to reflect on what they said last year, what was actually done last year, and what was not done.
Rebecca Markey-Towler, research fellow at Melbourne Climate Futures, has raised concerns that COP30 is the first climate summit to formally acknowledge temperature goals in the Paris Agreement won't be achieved.
It's an alarming recognition of the fact that the world is currently not on track to keep global warming to those temperature goals in the Paris Agreement. So the fact that actually in this agreement we've seen recognition that the world is really not on track to be keeping warming to 1.5 degrees, and even at this point, countries' climate pledges, they were due back in February of this year, and still countries have failed to update their nationally determined contributions to reduce their emissions. So I think the agreement is a landmark in recognising that we're not on track and that more really needs to be done to keep that warming to 1.5 degrees and to limit that overshoot to as much as possible.
As Australia won't be the location for the next COP, even with Australia being given the vice presidency of the next one, do you believe the interests of Pacific nations that are struggling, like Fiji, will receive proper attention?
I think that, for me, is one of the real disappointments that came out of this COP. The fact that Australia and the Pacific were going to lead the COP negotiations for next year, that would have been a real landmark in terms of really listening to the moral voice of climate change. These small island developing states who are really at the forefront of climate change, and it should be really clear that we have a moral imperative to act, as well as many other reasons to act because of their unique vulnerability. I hope that in its co-presidency role that Australia will continue to advocate for those Pacific Island voices and really make them front and centre, because Australia has a real responsibility to make sure that we, as a huge fossil fuel exporter and consumer of fossil fuels, that we are doing as much as we can, given our privileged status, to help reduce the significant impacts on our developing country island neighbour states and actually make sure these Pacific voices are really heard. And these Pacific voices are so powerful.
Rebecca Markey-Towler, research fellow at Melbourne Climate Futures, speaking with The Wire's Sam Giorgio.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
Loneliness. It's been termed an epidemic, and as many as one in three Australians are feeling its impact. That's according to the 2023 State of the Nation report. But how is a pilot project overcoming one of the most challenging public health issues of our time? Just over 1 year ago, Spark was launched in the Adelaide Hills, hosting a suite of community-led initiatives geared towards fostering connection, creating social cohesion, and combating loneliness. But it was back in 2022 that the concept of Spark was conceived from the Loneliness Project, which is a collaboration between the University of South Australia and the Hutt Community Centre. So, what have been some of the responses, and how is the community involved in solutions?
I'm Dr. Nadia Corsini, Senior Research Fellow from the Rosemary Bryant AO Research Centre at UniSA.
And I'm Hayley Everest. I'm the Community Engagement Lead of Spark.
I understand that, you know, you launched Spark in 2024 about this time. So it's been running for a year. How has the program gone, and what have you seen in terms of community connection and improved well-being?
It's been just such a fabulous initiative that we run. As a researcher, it's very rare to be so close to the action, so to speak, with a, you know, a community program. So it's been an absolute thrill to see it evolve and grow. What we've seen is a great sense of community energy. We discovered that there are a number of people in the community that are willing to create and innovate solutions to address loneliness.
Hayley, what have you observed in the first year, I guess on the ground and in terms of this coming to fruition?
I think what we've noticed is a willingness for people to open up about their experiences. The fact that in our communications, we're very open about wanting people to come along who are perhaps, you know, new to the area or feeling lonely and isolated or just seeking more connection in their lives. The fact that they know that they're coming to Spark for that genuine connection, we're seeing, I guess, relationships build more quickly, vulnerability between people open up perhaps more quickly than in other social settings, and that real sense of trust and community and spirit.
Nadia, what motivated you to focus research efforts or develop co-created solutions around loneliness with, first of all, the Loneliness Project, but then the broader collaboration and Spark?
It's a great story, Emma. In 2022, we had an opportunity to design a research project with the community, and we were given a broad remit. Our topic was women's health and healthy aging. And we went out and we spoke to women in the community, we spoke to organisations and asked them what were their priorities, what are their biggest concerns in relation to healthy aging. So originally there was no discussion about loneliness at all. We were asking women what was important to them to help them age well. And of course, you can imagine lots of topics came up in those conversations. But what bubbled to the surface was a strong message about people, particularly women, putting themselves last. And so from there, we talked about the challenge of loneliness, the challenge of feeling lack of belonging.
And, you know, now we're approaching the festive season, New Year. Why is it so important to be aware of loneliness right now and its impacts? And what can people do for themselves and others at this time? Or should councils be playing a bigger role in helping community members connect?
I think this time of year is a really interesting time because it's a busy time for many. It's not a busy time for everybody. And it can be a busy time and you can socialise a lot, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the connection or the socialisation that you're having is indeed making you feel more connected or less lonely. And so I think it's really important to tune into that for yourself at this time of year. What is the connection that actually serves you? And in this busy period, to look after yourself.
I think councils and community centres and community organisations already do a fantastic job. Why we're partnering with community organisations on this project, because they do this well. The people working in those organisations know how to do community connection.
I'm aware that recently Spark received almost $500,000 from the federal government for expansion. So what's next?
So we've tested the model with the Hutt Community Centre in Adelaide Hills, and the next project will be testing the model in two new council areas with 14 partners.
Dr. Nadia Cassini, Senior Research Fellow from the Rosemary Bryant AO Research Centre at the University of South Australia, and Hayley Everiss, Community Engagement Lead of Spark, speaking with me. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for being with me. I'm Emma Watsky from Radio Adelaide here in Tandanya. Stay tuned for tomorrow's show brought to you from 4EB in Brisbane. The Wire is a weekday co-production between 2SER in Gadigal, Sydney, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Meanjin, Brisbane and Melbourne, and Radio Adelaide, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can also hop online to check out our stories at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, X and LinkedIn. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you tomorrow evening on The Wire.